Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 165. I'm recording it on Thursday, September 17th, 2009. The P10 level today is 18. That's not awful. It's not great. The long-term value proposition of stocks is mixed today. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod at Incompetech.com. The title of the selection is Blue Paint. The title of the podcast is I Was Wrong. There is an economic reason why we will see another stock crash. One of the reasons I do these podcasts, and definitely one of the reasons I post on discussion boards, it's not just to share my wisdom with you, although I hope that from time to time I can offer something of some value. It's to learn. I am a big believer in, I mean, there's all, you know, I'm tempted to say I'm a big believer in the internet. I am. I think the internet, I'm a journalist by background. The last podcast was entitled, I'm a journalist, not an investing expert. And as a journalist, going back a long number of years now, I saw huge potential in the internet discussion board and also the blog as a communications medium of the future. I see great power in it, mainly because of the community interaction. I love books. You know, I love magazines, I love speeches, there are all sorts of communications media. But the discussion board or the blog has an element of community interaction that these others don't have, and humans learn through community interaction. We don't learn by analyzing syllogisms. We learn by voicing our thoughts and getting feedback from people we trust, usually friends or family members, coworkers, neighbors. That's how we learn. And discussion boards allow us to replicate this, and they allow us to create communities that aren't just your neighbors or your coworkers, but groups of people with an interest in a particular subject. And there is such power in this idea. And this was the reason why I began building up the Retire Early Board at Motley Fool back in May of 1999. I saw this potential and I said, I had been studying how to retire early for, I don't know, I started in 91, so 8 years. And I wanted to create a community of the greatest savers in the world and have them all trading ideas. And that worked. We had a fantastic community until it was destroyed by abusive posting, but it worked. And then ultimately, because of my efforts to protect that community from the abusive posters, I turned to the subject of investing. And now I've directed all my energies to investing for the past 7 years. And again, it's worked. We've had, you know, it's been tumultuous. We've had friction. We've had ugliness, all this sort of thing. But we've had amazing insights, just amazing stuff. We're ahead. We're ahead of all these big name experts, not because they're dumb, but just because they're not taking advantage of this new communications medium. It's a powerful, powerful thing. So I try to do that. I think that's the reason why I sometimes have an edge. I think I have an edge. I mean, that's what I believe. You be the judge. But I think I've got some insights being put forward at this website that are not available anywhere else. And it's not because I'm the smartest guy on the block. It's because I take advantage of this communications medium, and I just happen to stumble into this and so forth. But a couple things have happened lately that have me thinking about this question, and I've thought about it before. It comes up a lot. We're sort of in a weird, well, all times are weird. It's always a crooked piece of time when you're living in it. But, you know, we had a long period of time from 1996 through September of 2008, almost 13 years. Stocks were insanely overvalued for that entire time period. So it was very easy for me. You know, our discussions began in May of 2002. And from that date through September of 2008, it was pretty easy for me to say, you know, what the bottom line is. I'd say, look, stocks are insanely overvalued. You know, I always said, don't go to a zero stock allocation, but I said maybe 20%, maybe 30, but anything above that would make me nervous at these sorts of prices. So I was able to give consistent, clear advice for a long time. Now we're in sort of a twilight zone because the P10 level's much, much, much better, much improved. I mean, at the low point after the crash, we went down to 12, which is an outstanding P10 level. We're now at 18, which is a little on the high side, but it's not dangerous, really, in an objective sense. So for the entire time since September of 2008, the P10 level's been far improved, the best it's been since the early 90s. And, but yet, we have this dark cloud hanging over us. The prospect of a second stock crash. It's actually, there's been more than two. You know, if you count, I believe most people refer to what happened in September of 2008 as the stock crash. My view is there have been multiple stock crashes. We had the tech crash back in 99, I guess it was. And then we had what I think of as the slow leak crash from 2000 through 2008. You know, where there was no dramatic event, but stocks were not increasing in price for, you know, 9 years. And then we had the dramatic crash in September of 2008, and we're probably going to have another crash of equal size coming up in the next few years. So that's four crashes altogether. But anyway, let's call it the second crash, just for to make it easier to talk about. The second dramatic crash. Now, my logic for believing there's going to be another crash, and I am not dogmatic about it. I was fairly dogmatic about the idea there was going to be a first crash because I said, look, you know, stocks are, you know, the valuations are, at the high point, they were 3 times fair value. Through that entire time period, they were 2 times fair value. You can't continue at 2 times fair value indefinitely. So there had to be a crash sooner or later. So I was fairly, you know, certain about that. I don't feel nearly as certain about the next crash, but the reality is there have been 4 times in U.S. history when we've gone to a P10 level of over 25. P10 level of over 25. The insanely overvalued level. And the first 3 times we ended up in the time following at a P10 level of 7 or 8. Half a fair value. So the default position has to be that's where we're going to end up. And if, you know, if we're now at 18 and we go to 7, that's a drop of, you know, more than 50%. So we're talking about another stock crash equal in size to the one we saw in September 2008. So you have to take that, I think, if you're a rational investor, you have to take that as your most likely scenario. But certainly you don't want to take it as the only scenario. We don't want to get too big for our britches and start thinking we know everything. But you have to take that as the default. But I get into I get put in a box. And this happened last night. This is why I think I was thinking about it, and I sort of came up with the idea for this podcast when I woke up this morning. You know how when you go to sleep, your mind works away at puzzles that you've been thinking about during the day. Just before I went to bed last night, I had gotten an email that a new post had gone up at a thread from, I don't know, maybe 3-4 weeks ago at the Oblivious Investor blog. And that's a blog run by Mike Piper. Mike is a good guy, and I agree with a lot of what Mike advocates, but he does advocate passive investing, which I obviously do not at all advocate. I advocate valuation-informed indexing. Excuse me. So there was a thread there where one of the goons had come on. I had made some comments, and one of the grainy goons had come on and made some abusive comments. And a guy happened to see this, checking out old blog post. And he added, there's an email feature. When a new comment goes to the thread, I receive an email because I participated in the thread. And this guy came on, he says, let's not give Rob such a hard time. He says, all Rob is really saying is what Benjamin Graham said many years ago in the security analysis. He's saying, buy more stocks when the price is low and less when the price is high. And that's all true. Benjamin Graham is the originator of the valuation-informed indexing concept. The only problem Benjamin Graham had was there were no indexes in his day. He recommended this approach, but the approach is far more powerful when you have index funds rather than investing in individual stocks, and Benjamin Graham didn't have individual stocks available to him. So Benjamin Graham should get the credit for developing this concept, and I just, I'll just run with things. If I find something that works, I just jump on it, and I say, hey, let's go. So this guy was defending me, and Mike got on. Mike Piper got on. And Mike offered some comments that were perfectly legitimate, and he just said, his comments were fine. And he said, well, I hope I don't pick on Rob too much. And I said, well, thanks for that, Mike. And he said, Benjamin Graham does endorse this, which was good of him to say. Sometimes the passive investing advocates will deny the basic facts of reality, Mike did not do that. But he added a comment that troubled me a little bit. He said, the guy had asked what valuation metric I used. And Mike said, well, Rob uses PE10. He knows that about me. But he said, I don't know what PE10 he considers good or bad. And people ask that all the time. And I saw this comment, so I went in and responded. But I said, and I basically said, look, I said, yes, I use PE10. And I said, actually, Benjamin Graham's the one who came up with PE10. And I said, in terms of which ones are good and bad, 14 is fair value. Anything up to 20 is fine. 20 is the warning track. 20 is when things start to get dangerous. And at 25, you're at insane stock valuations. And we've been at 25 four times, and the average price drop on those four occasions is 68%. So you don't want to be with a heavy stock allocation when we're at 25, as we were from the entire time period from January of 96 through October of 2008, with the exception of a couple of months where we went to 23. We were above 25 the entire time period. So I gave an answer to the question that I, felt it was a fine answer, but it was gnawing at me a little bit that I felt that Mike's question, well, it wasn't a question, but he just said he didn't know what PE10 level I thought was good. It's one that I get asked all the time from, let's say, skeptics. Mike is a non-abusive skeptic, but I guess I get it from abusive skeptics too. People have a hard time with this. I think the biggest problem with valuation informed indexing is it's so great. It's such a great strategy. The benefits are just so overwhelming that people can't believe it's true. And they just say, first of all, there can't be anything this great. You get, you know, greatly reduced risk, greatly increased returns, greatly diminished anxiety over stock investing. It all makes sense. It all fits. The historical data supports it for the entire record. I mean, can anything be this great? And then on top of that, you're some guy on the internet telling us about it. How could anything be so great? And the only guy who knows about it is some guy who posts on the internet. You know, it's an unbelievable story. Well, I'll give you that one. It is. It's unbelievable. But it's unbelievable to me. But of course, I try to explain it. And I think the big thing going on is, the stock selling industry, almost all the experts, the people we think of as experts, have ties to the stock selling industry, and it is not in their interest as an industry to tell people when they should get out of stocks. They just, in terms of the industry, they always want you in stocks. So they can't tell you. That's really what I think is the most simple explanation. And the investors who should be calling them on it, we should be looking out for our own interests, not the interest of the stock selling industry. But we're compromised. We're bought into. We're essentially like, it's like we're all in the stock selling industry, because once we go with excessive stock allocations, we want to think we're right. We don't want to admit we got it wrong. So we spend all our efforts rationalizing instead of thinking things through. Anyway, I get asked this question, and I want to give better answers to it. And people want there to be, you know, and I got this from Artie, my friend Artie. He's a poster at the blog and a smart guy. And he used to ask me this all the time. He says, Rob, you got to do a chart where you list PE10 levels and you say which ones are good and which ones are bad. And I just said, Artie, I don't know. The answers aren't so simple. I mean, it's not that it's complicated. It's what it is that the higher the PE10 level goes, the higher the price of stocks is. So obviously, higher is worse. You know, you can make a statement like that, and it's always true. But you know, whether an 18 PE10 level is a time to go with the 60% allocation or not, that's a harder question, because you have to look at what alternatives are available to you. If you've got, you know, I can look it up. I don't know what the long-term return is at 18, but I think I can look it up here. Got my computer. See what the return predictor says. See what I'm looking for what the 10-year annualized real return is. Well, we're actually at 19 today. I said 18. It looks like it's been moved up to 19. Most likely 10-year return is 3.5 real for the purchase of the S&P index today's price. That's, I don't know, 3.5 real. Now, I don't know, if you went out and got a super safe asset class like I-bonds or TIPS or certificates of deposit, I don't know what they're paying today. I haven't looked, but let's say 2% real. That usually you can get something for 2% real, not always, usually. So you're getting 1.5 added return for being in stocks. Well, I don't think that's enough, especially not today. So, you know, with all the craziness going on. So I would say stocks are not a great deal today. But, you know, in other circumstances, you know, there was a time, I don't think it was too long ago, a year or two ago, when I-bonds were down, they were paying about zero. They were paying just about 0%. So you might say, when they're paying 0%, maybe you're willing to live with 3.5. Maybe you would, you know. And the alternative is, there was a time when TIPS were paying 4% real. When they're paying 4% real with no risk, you sure as shooting don't want to be too heavy in stocks that are paying only 3.5 long term. 10 years is long term. So you've got to look at the... You can't just look at the price of the thing. You've got, it's sort of like saying, you know, is $300 a good price for a television? Well, it depends. You know, how many televisions you got? If you don't have a television, 300's probably a good deal. You know, you'll miss a lot of things if you don't have a television. On the other hand, if you've already got three, you know, maybe it's sort of a waste of money. You've already got one in the living room and one in the kitchen and one in the bedroom. You don't need a fourth. Or, you know, it might depend how much money you have. If you've got $1 million in the bank, spending $300 for a fourth television is no big deal. But if you're down to your, you know, seeds and stems, you know, maybe you ought to save that money. It's the same way with stocks. I can tell you what the price of stocks is by going to the stock return predictor, but I can't say if it's a good price for you or not without knowing your circumstances. If you have lost money in the stock crash, a significant amount of money, then stocks are more risky for you than they are for somebody who was going with a zero stock allocation when prices crashed, as I was. Because if you've just lived through a crash and now you have another crash, you're probably going to bail on stocks and not get back in for a long time, and that's going to hurt you seriously. So the risk is really high for you if you've suffered already. And I just don't know when somebody... I had a neighbor, and he asked me a question. He sent me an email yesterday morning. So this is why all this stuff's been churning around in my mind. And he's in some sort of group. I don't know what. And they have some money to invest. And he said a lot of people, they're very afraid to put the money in stocks. And they're, you know, he's sort of like saying, what do you recommend? And I hate that question because just for the reason, I think that's what prompted me to do that podcast yesterday where I said, I'm a journalist, not an investing expert. You know, I don't want to answer that question because I'm not the one who should be answering that question. I'm a journalist. But the problem is, if they don't listen to me, they're going to listen to somebody else. And from the stock selling industry is going to promote passive investing. In other words, the journalism issues are today dominant. If you can't get honest reporting on what we've learned from the academic research 28 years ago, everybody's in a fix. Everybody's in a pickle. So I did give him an answer, but I prefaced it by saying, I am not an investing expert. I am a journalist. As a journalist, I'm here to tell you, please check it out on your own. But, you know, what I understand from everything I've looked at is the Robert Shiller published research in 1981 showing that valuations affect long-term returns, and the stock selling industry has elected to ignore the implications of that research for 30 years now. And as a result, we're all in quite a pickle. So be careful out there. Anyway, so all this stuff was churning in my head. And I always, in this period we're in today, I often say, well, now that we're up at 19, I probably don't have to say it anymore. 19, the most likely long-term return of stocks is only 3.5. That's just not enough in my mind to justify a high stock allocation. I don't think it's enough. But this is the highest we've been since the crash. We haven't been at 19. We were, you know, at one point we were down at 12, which is a fantastic long-term return. So I was very tempted then. Well, I was saying on all those podcasts, I would say, you know, we're now at 12, or we're now at 14, or we're now at 15. And I'd say, stocks offer a strong long-term value proposition, because they did. But I'd always say long-term, because I always have this thought in the back of my head that we're going to see another stock crash because of the historical record, that we've always seen it before. But I always felt a little funny, because I'd say, well, you know, it's sort of like I'm saying the P10 level is good. I can't say the P10 level today is actually not good. But let's say before that, let's say when we were 15 or 16. The P10 level is good, but yet I'm telling people not to go with a really high stock allocation. Well, that's sort of a conflict, isn't it? Aren't you the guy who believes in P10? P10 level's good, Rob. Come on. Put all your money in stocks now. Aren't you contradicting yourself? And the way I've addressed it is I've said, well, there's no economic reason for a crash, because we're at fair value. There's no economic reason for a crash. When we're at 15, that's fair value. And even at 19, there might be an economic reason for a drop, but I wouldn't call it a crash. If we went from 19 to 15, that's not a crash. That's just, you know, it's a price drop, but it's not a crash. So there's no economic reason. Whereas when we were at 29, if you go to fair value, that's a crash. 29 down to 15 is a crash, any way you look at it. So I'd say there's no economic reason for a crash, but there's an emotional reason. That's the way I would square it. I'd say, well, it's the reason it's happened on the three earlier occasions is when prices start to go down, it hits people emotionally. They lose confidence in the markets, and price doesn't go down to fair value. It goes to half of fair value. You just keep going. Not necessarily all at once, though. You could have, you know, a crash that takes you from 29, where we were, you know, a year, maybe 2 years ago, and then you know, you go from 29 down to 12, but then you go back up to 19, then you go back down to 7. So it could come in stages. So I have always felt uneasy. It's still a little complicated. In other words, I now feel I'm getting a better grasp of it. But in terms of explaining it quickly, it's hard because what people want are these one word answers. You know, thumbs up, thumbs down. Put my money in stocks or not? Thumbs up, thumbs down. You know, and it's just a little more. It's not complicated, but it's a little more complicated than that. It's not. I love to put out podcasts that have that start in the title, I was wrong, because that just, you know, magnifies the point that this ain't your father's investing approach, investing model. This is something different. This ain't passive investing with all its pomposity and arrogance and know-it-allism. This is an approach that at least aims at humility. And by admitting where we get things wrong, that underlines the point and helps us. So, I think I've been wrong to say there's no economic reason for another stock crash. I now feel I woke up this morning saying, no, there is an economic reason. Well, what's the economic reason? Well, and I explained this again somewhere yesterday, probably at a different blog. I was talking about, it helps to put this in dollar terms. At the top of the bubble, January of 2000, stocks were triple. The P10 level was 44. That's three times fair value. Fair value was 14. And I calculated once, it was a very rough calculation, back of the envelope calculation, what that meant in dollar terms. How much, I call it pretend money. How much pretend money? I wrote a guest blog post once called The Curse of Pretend Money. The damage that the phony money created by passive investing, what it does to our economy. When we're three times fair value, what that means is every $1,000 worth of stock is being temporarily priced at $3,000. Every $10,000 worth of stock is being temporarily priced at $30,000. Every $100,000 worth of stock is being temporarily priced at $300,000. It's a game we play. Because we don't adjust our portfolio statements for real value, which is what I think we should do. When stocks are valued at three times fair value, they should be reporting the nominal number. You know, your portfolio is worth $300,000, and then they should be adjusting it for valuations and saying, well, the real value is $100,000, so that you know not to go out and buy a new car because you don't have the money to buy a new car. You're in no circumstances to buy a new car. But if they tell you got $300,000, you're going to make all kinds of stupid financial moves. They're going to hurt you for many years to come. We all need to know the real value of our portfolios, for heaven's sakes. This is controversial. For heaven's sakes, how can we plan our financial affairs? How can we plan early retirements? For heaven's sakes. That's where this all got started, at a retire early board. People planning to hand in resignations from high-paying jobs, and they don't even know what their financial circumstances are. They're using portfolio statements put out by the stock selling industry that doesn't include that do not include valuation adjustments. Well, I did this back of the envelope calculation for how much phony money was working its way through the U.S. economy in January 2000. And I used a number. John Bogle gave a number. He said we lost $9 trillion in the crash. Then I added $9 trillion was only counting what we lost in the crash. We had been losing money going back to January 2000, but at a much slower rate. That came to about another $3 trillion. So you're up to $12 trillion. In other words, we had $12 trillion of phony money because we ended up at fair value. So anything we had above that was phony money. So we had about $12 trillion phony money. And then there was another $4 trillion we lost in the housing crash. So if you add that in, you'd have $16 trillion. And the housing crash was ultimately caused by passive investing because it's the... perhaps not 100%, but it's the wealth, the phony wealth that people thought they had in stocks that caused people to overspend on housing. So you add that in and you got $16 trillion phony money. Well, what's happened? Now, the $16 trillion is now gone. So you could say, and this is what I'd been saying in the past, you could say the economic reason for a further crash is gone. It's not true today at 19, but it was true when we were at 14 or 15. And it's close enough to being true. The economic reason for a crash is gone. The $16 trillion has it gone poof. It's evaporated. So we don't have to worry anymore about it evaporating, right? We can stabilize it at where we are. No. And I've always been thinking the reason why we can't stabilize is because of emotional factors. But it's really more than that. Because there really are economic factors here. Because what happened is the $16 trillion was used to do things like start businesses that are undercapitalized. When you take the $16 trillion out, they are undercapitalized. So these businesses are going to fail. And just because we went down to a P10 level of 15 doesn't mean that all those businesses instantly fail. You see, it takes years for this to play out. It takes years for this to work its way through the system. So what happens is, even though we're at a P10... being at a P10 level of, I think the way I would say it is, financially, the cause of the crash has been eliminated. The pretend money has been pulled out of the system. It's gone poof. But the economy doesn't run just on dollars. The economy runs, you know, people have to go out and start businesses. And you take the capitalization away and they can't compete. But that doesn't mean they fold up the tent. And a lot of the people who have these businesses that they're trying to survive, they don't even understand that passive investing doesn't work. They know they took a hit, obviously. But a lot of them are thinking, hey, if stocks go back, maybe I'll survive. But of course, if all we did was fall from 3x fair value down to fair value, stocks ain't coming back. So they're not going to survive. But it's going to take years for that to work its way through the system. In other words, what we did when we promoted passive investing, the most reckless act, the most reckless financial act in the history of the United States, in Rob Bennett's opinion, the promotion of passive investing for 28 years after Robert Shiller did his research, we caused thousands and thousands and thousands of businesses to be formed that were not properly capitalized. And those businesses are now in the process of folding. Some of them, of course, have already folded. But many have not. Many are hanging on. And it's going to take months or years for all of the bad stuff to happen. And only then can we start moving up again. Now, does that... See, that forces a P10 level lower than fair value. There's a sense in which a P10 level lower than fair value is economically unjustified. There's a sense in which it's irrational. Why should the P10 level go? Why should stocks be marked down? Why should they be selling at a discount? That's irrational. And if we're rational investors, which we aspire to be, we shouldn't be expecting stocks to be marked to lower than fair value, should we? The answer that I've come to after sleeping on it is yes, we should. Because what we did, if stocks had always been at 15, they never would have dropped below 15. They would just always stay at fair value. But when you pump them up to 44, you put conditions in place that force a drop not to fair value, but a drop to half a fair value. Because these businesses that fail, these people are left without a livelihood. And all the workers are left without a livelihood. And that has, that has effects throughout the economy. When the workers are left without a livelihood, they can't buy things. They can't buy houses. They can't buy cars. They can't buy vacations. It spreads doom and gloom as they tell their friends about their plight. Others get scared and start to save more. As they save more, other businesses fail. There's domino effects. When you allow passive investing to be promoted, you are playing with dynamite in a consumer economy. A consumer economy cannot withstand the promotion of such a reckless investing model, in Rob Bennett's opinion. So the point of all this is, it's not quite right to say that there's no economic reason why we need to go to half a fair value. There is an economic reason. It's a temporary economic reason. Ultimately, I believe we will go back to fair value, but it's going to take years to handle the economic displacement. All of our assets were put into wrong things because none of us knew how much money we had. We were all playing with funny money. None of us knew how much money we had. And so the entire economy, everything's messed up. And it takes years to straighten it out. And while we're in the process of straightening it out, we're not going to be at fair value. We're going to be at worse than fair value because temporarily we have dealt ourselves a huge blow. So there are not just emotional reasons why we are going to drop below fair value. They're also economic. And so that makes me more confident. I've been saying all along, my expectation is there would be another crash, but I've been saying 70% odds. I think I would now say 80%. In other words, I am now feeling more and more, not 95% like I would have said before the crash, that there was going to be a crash, but I would say maybe 75, maybe 80% confident. I feel more confident all the time that there's going to be a second crash. Because I think it's more than just emotion. There's an economic reason for it. Now, as you start to talk about this sort of thing, something that comes up, of course, we have this question of the stimulus. Now, the stimulus is, the purpose of it is to deal with the economic displacement. And the question is, can it work? And we have two theories, and I think they're both flawed. And I have only a layman's understanding of economics. So, I'm not an investing expert, but even less am I an economist. Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe the economists don't know what they're talking about. I hate to say such things, but I'm coming to that view as time goes by. The classical school, conservative economics, I think it's stupid to assign political labels, but this, the classical schools tends to be the conservative school, says that the stimuluses generally are not a good thing, that you generally want to leave things to the market and not get government involved. I don't agree, because I think there are times when the market is irrational. You see, I think actually the whole problem with passive investing is an overconfidence in market solutions. So I don't believe in putting all confidence in the market. There are times when I think a stimulus really does make sense, where the cause of a recession is, I don't know, you know, people losing their jobs, and you need to give them some confidence, and there's a big payoff. In other words, if you can just get confidence up, you can get the whole economy going again, and you solved a problem, and it's money well spent. You know, just because it's got government heading on it doesn't make it bad, in Rob Bennett's opinion. However, so I reject classical. You know, I don't reject the whole model, but I reject it if you take it too rigidly. But the Keynesian approach, the so-called liberal approach, is a response to the classical conservative approach. The Keynesian approach says get government in there and manage the economy. That's where all these ideas of stimulus plans come in. The problem, I also reject that in part because while I think there are circumstances where government needs to step in because the market can't get its act together, there are circumstances where that's true, but there are lots of circumstances where the government can't do any better than the market, and the stimulus just won't get the job done. And I think the question that decides which situation applies is, what is the cause of the recession? Is the cause just emotion, that people are feeling blue? If people are just feeling down, maybe you can make them feel better with a stimulus. But if the cause is real, and in this case the cause is very, very, very real, people have taken on businesses they can't handle, and people have taken on spending they can't handle. People are seeing their retirements fail. People are seeing, you know, they were putting numbers into calculators for years, saying, well, my money's going to compound this much, and I'm going to be able to retire. And a lot of people were barely going to make it by 65, some 70. You hear people saying, I'm going to keep working past 65. And if they were planning on retiring at 70 before the crash, maybe now it's looking like 80. Well, you're going to have a hard time talking those people into spending a lot of money. So this is not a case where a stimulus in general is going to work. It may work at the edges. But in general, this is a case where stimulus dollars are just not, they're not going to have the effect, because the economic problem is not a psychological problem. There is a psychological element. But it's also real. There is this real economic displacement. You know, misallocation of resources. And a stimulus doesn't change that. So, I sort of reject both of those models. I think we need a new model. You know, I argue for a new model in investing, rational instead of passive. I think we need a new model for understanding our economy, but that's a subject, the investing subject taxes my skills to the limit. That's a subject beyond my abilities. But I think we need sort of a behavioral finance model of economics that would acknowledge that there's a role for government, but that would also acknowledge that just putting money in government doesn't solve the problem. It's just not that simple. You need to have some idea of the cause of the economic slowdown. And we just don't have that. Nobody talks about it. We had this crash, and there was a certain panic, and people were sort of saying, what's the reason? And then they come up with this stupid reason that the bankers did it. And that was the end of the discussion, and we went on to other things. We passed bills, we spent money, but we've never had a clear understanding of what caused this crash. Rob Bennett believes irresponsible promotion of passive investing caused this economic crisis. And the way out of it, the way to restore confidence in the market and in our economic system and even in our political system, is to start shooting straight with people about how stock investing works. And that means acknowledging the academic research that shows that valuations affect long-term returns, which has been around for 28 years now. That's my opinion. I think that's the thing that gets it all moving in the right direction. And of course, there are people that sort of talk about it, but a lot of people don't want to hear that. But I, you know, the worry here is that if we have another, we have another crash, I presume that people will be more open to hearing it, because you see more openness now than you did before the crash. It's a big difference. But boy, if it's going to take another crash to get us there, I don't know. We're causing ourselves a lot of pain. And it's hard to watch. It's hard to watch. But I believe that ultimately we need to consider, you know, a new understanding of economics, because that really is the cause of this. It's not the investing stuff I got involved in because I was trying to help people how to put together retire early plans, and you can't do it unless you know how much money you have. And you can't do it unless you know how to invest. So I was sort of forced into that. But passive investing wasn't developed in a vacuum. It was developed in accord with our understanding of how economics works. It's really just the classical economics school, the Adam Smith invisible hand, applied in a practical way to investing decisions. That's what the efficient market is. And there's insights to be developed from that, but it's not an accurate portrayal of what an economy is about. And we're now in a modern era where the middle class has money to invest. It's not just a small group of rich people who are getting burned in these stock crashes. It's the broad middle class, and the middle class, our economy depends on the middle class. So we've got to acknowledge these realities. You can't say not understanding investing has worked all these years. We can stay. We've got to work to come to a better understanding. Something you hear all the time, it gets on my nerves, is people will say they will acknowledge that the efficient market doesn't, is discredited. They'll acknowledge that passive investing doesn't work. Michael Kitsis, a financial planner in Maryland, said to me, he says a lot of financial planners are having doubts. But then what they'll say is they say two things. One, they say, maybe passive investing doesn't work, but there's no better model out there. There's no better model out there. So by default, we have to stay with it. Well, that is lame. If it doesn't work, you don't stand up in front of a room and tell people to invest according to it. If there's no better model, you stand up in front of the room and you say, we don't have a good model. Here's what the passives think. Here's what some other people think. But truth be told, we don't know what works as of today. You shoot straight with people. If a lot of people don't believe in rational investing. Frankly, they haven't studied it. So how could they believe it? But if you don't know, say you don't know. Don't say, we don't have a better model. This model doesn't work, but if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. You got to replace it. If you don't have anything to replace it with, you don't have anything. You stand up there and you say, I guess I'm a dunce. I'm a dunderhead. I'm supposed to be giving investing advice, but I know that the model is broken and I don't have any other. So I don't know. At least that's honest. But the truth of the matter is, if they would acknowledge they sort of tentatively acknowledge that the model's broken. They just don't want to say it. But if they would say openly the model's broken, the truth is the next step would be then they would study. They'd say, well, we need a new model. Let's all get our heads together and find a new model. And that's, of course, what I did. And once you do that, it's not as if all the answers are handed to you in a day. But over the course of 7 years, I think it'd be fair to say I've developed a good number of insights. They weren't handed to me any more than they'd be handed to John Bogle or Bill Bernstein or Scott Burns or Jonathan Clements or anybody else. They don't get handed to you. Do the work. Think. Write, speak, ask questions, look at data, develop calculators. That's how it's done. So that's one of the things they say. They'll say, you know, the model's broke, but we don't have anything better. You don't have anything better because you're not looking. You know, get to work. Somebody has to say it. The second thing they say is, oh, the investors, though, they're so emotional, the portiers, they can't handle the truth. They're emotional because you're teaching them passive investing. Passive investing is, at its core, pure emotion. This came up this morning. Again, at the Oblivious Investor blog, Mike's blog entry for today was about tuning out the noise. He said, you have to not get emotionally involved when you lose money or when, you know, prices go up too much. I said, Mike, yeah, you know, you're on the right track here. But, you know, the last sentence of his blog was, does anybody have any ideas for how to tune out the noise? I said, yeah, I have an idea. It's the same idea I push every day, every time I comment here. You know, give up passive investing and adopt valuation-informed indexing, because there's a magic to it. The magic is, whenever the return is more than 6.5, that's going to cause your estimate of the long-term return to drop. So every price increase beyond 6.5, every artificial price increase, has both a good element to it and a bad element. It pumps your portfolio value up in the short term and pumps it down in the long term. And you end up even. And the same thing's true with price drops. Every price drop causes the long-term return to go up in the stock return predictor. So every price drop is bad news in the short term. It makes your portfolio value less, but good news in the long term because it pumps up your long-term return. So, what have you got? You've got reality. You've got stocks providing 6.5 real per year, which is what they do. When you buy an index fund, you're buying a share of the U.S. economy, and the productivity of the U.S. economy has been enough to finance a return of 6.5 real for years and years and years. So that's what you're getting when you allow your money to be held in an index fund. Broad index fund. So the beauty of valuation-informed indexing is it tunes you into reality. And when you're tuned into reality, guess what? All the emotional noise just dissipates. What you're doing is you're learning on a daily basis how stock investing works. And what people tend to think is you learn, you know, by somebody giving you a syllogism to figure out. That's not right. Some learning is done by solving puzzles, but a lot of learning is done just by habit, just by repeating the message over and over. And the passives are repeating the message, I live in a fantasy world. All stock investing is based on fantasy. Price makes no difference. I can hold the same allocation and pay no penalty. It's all fantasy. And every day they're repeating that fantasy to themselves and becoming worse and worse and worse investors. More and more and more emotional. Whereas the valuation-informed indexer, every day, he's repeating rational messages, and he's becoming more and more and more confident that he understands what's going on, which gives him the power to tune out the noise. Mike has the right idea when he says tune out the noise, but What he doesn't have, and what the other passive investing advocates don't have, is a way to actually make it happen. And the way to make it happen is to be tuned into reality. The only thing that can defeat the noise is the reality principle. And it's only by knowing the price of the stocks you have bought that you can really get a grasp, the grasp on reality you need to be able to tune out the noise effectively. Now, I think the last point I wanted to make was just this question of economic growth. What's being suggested, if you're reading a little between the lines in what I'm saying in the podcast, is economic growth is not always a good thing. If You can. There's such a thing as real economic growth, which of course is based on realities, and there's such a thing as fake economic growth, and that's what we had. When we allowed the P10 level to go to 3 times fair value, when we allowed that $16 trillion of phony money, pretend money, to be pumped through our economic system, what we were experiencing was fake economic growth. And please understand, this is a bipartisan phenomenon. We went to 44 in January of 2000. Clinton was president, a Democrat. Bush came in, and there was no change. I mean, there was a we didn't stay at 44, but we stayed at insanely high valuation levels for almost the entire Bush term until September of 2008, 2 months before the election. So Democrats and Republicans alike have been encouraging a phony money economy, phony economic growth. And it's taken as a given in political debates that this is what we want. It's taken as a given. But that's a good thing. If you go to a politician or, you know, a congressman, whatever it is, and you say, yeah, you know, I've got a way here to get more economic growth next year, they're going to say, that's great, let's go with it. And that's not good. If the economy, if there's real growth, of course, that's good. But phony growth is actually, it's not neutral. It's not just that phony growth doesn't hang around, not as good as it looks, it's actually a negative. Because what phony growth does is it causes the misallocation of resources. The beauty of a capitalist economy, the whole point, is that a free market does a better job at allocating resources than does a government-controlled economy. This is why capitalism has the edge over communism. Instead of having some bureaucrat decide what product should be available and how much we should spend on products and all this sort of thing, a market decides it, and the market is more intelligent, mainly because the decisions are being made at the local level. They're being made at the consumer level, the individual level, rather than this bureaucrat who does not know all the facts and could never process all the facts, even if he had a brain of a supercomputer. But that all of that edge is lost when we pump the economy up artificially. Because when what allows a capitalist economy to have the magical power to allocate resources properly, it's done through information feedback. Businesses try certain things. They offer a product to see if it's going to be a success or not. And if they were smart, if they did a good job of analyzing what people need, they are rewarded financially. And that means that they make more decisions and we get more good decisions because we have good decision makers. But if they make poor decisions, they're penalized. All of that is lost when you pump $16 trillion of phony money into the economy. What's happening then is businesses that make poor decisions are being rewarded and businesses that make good decisions are being destroyed through the destructive power of a capitalist economy. And there is a destructive power. They call it creative destruction. Businesses that made good decisions in the 90s and 2000s were destroyed because their competitors were benefiting from the phony money pumped into the economy through the promotion of passive investing. And we're now suffering from having destroyed those businesses, and we're suffering from having propped up the businesses that were making bad decisions. We're not doing ourselves any favor. So we can't even talk about, you know, one of the things that's come up in some of the podcasts is we can no longer talk about investing without looking at political ramifications because there's an overlay. And now this podcast is exploring that we can't talk about the P10 level without looking at economic ramifications. And on another level, we can't talk about investing without talking about cultural and psychological implications because investors are humans and humans make decisions emotionally. And And so one of the conclusions we come to is a PE10 level of 18 is not a P10 level of 18, is not a P10 level of 18. There's not just one 18. There's the sort of 18 you would have if we were in a rebuilding process where you could say 18's a little high, but it's still a good P10 level. We're not in the danger zone yet. 20 is the danger zone. 25 is the insanely overvalued zone. So 18 is not great, but it's not that bad. There's a different 18 when the history is that, until a year ago, we were at two or three times fair value. That's an 18 that's not going to stick in all likelihood. Let's not get too dogmatic, but in all likelihood, we have another crash coming. That's a different kind of 18. That's why I can't make the chart that Artie is always asking me to make that says, oh, at 18, you should be at a stock allocation of X. There is no one stock allocation that corresponds to a P10 level of 18. I could tell you what the likely 10-year return is, but, and I think that 10-year return applies even today, but it applies with a stock crash in all likelihood coming first, which is a very different scenario from what we would have if we were building. It's a very different scenario. Because emotionally, a stock crash, it's going to affect the individual investor. It's going to scare the heck out of them. And two, it's going to bring our economy and possibly our political system to its knees. And that is going to have feedback effects on the stock market. If we go into a depression, that's going to affect stock prices. It's going to stretch this thing out. So you may not even get a good return in 10 years. There's no guarantee that we'll get a good return. The 3.5 is the most likely. But there are scenarios here. I can go back to the return predictor. Let's look at the worst case scenario. Worst case scenario is a return of 0.26. I'm sorry. The worst case scenario at today's price is a 10-year return of a negative 2.5. Negative 2.5. In 20 years, the worst case is a return of 0.26. So if we go into a depression, which we could if we suffer another 50% stock crash, we might be triggering the worst case scenario, which is in 10 years, this is an annualized loss. It's not a one-time loss of 2.5. It's every year for 10 years running, loss of 2.5. And for 20 years, a trivial gain of, quarter of a point. For 20 years running, that's where we could be today if this triggers a depression. And the odds of a depression are obviously higher than they would be if we hadn't already had a stock crash preceding this one. So you can't, a P10 level of 18, you can't say that they're all the same. There are different 18s. We're now at 19. 19 is not that great. It's only 3.5 after 10 years. And this is the worst kind of 19 you could have. This is a black 19, friends and neighbors. And I think we're handling it poorly. I had hopes when we saw the stock crash that people were sobering up. People were coming out and saying, hey, I love that letter to Money Magazine where the guy said, hey, how bad does it have to get before you guys change your advice? And I was hopeful that Money was going to change his advice and talk seriously about the new model, or at least about developing a new model, or at least about having a national debate to begin developing a new model. Instead, we've all gone back to sleep. We've allowed stock prices to go up to 19 again. That was, in Rob Bennett's opinion, that was the most irresponsible thing we could have done. Arguably more irresponsible than what we did before the crash, because before the crash, we hadn't been scared to death. Now we have been. So the standards, the test should be harder. We should expect more of ourselves. So not a bright, optimistic, cheery podcast discussing the possibility of a depression, but one that I think needs to be recorded for two reasons. One, people who are listening before the second crash, presuming we have one, no one knows for sure. I'm giving you my thoughts, and that's all I can do. People who are listening perhaps can prepare. And you know, don't do it because I say it. Think through what I say and do it only if you're convinced and only if other, you know, information sources back up what I'm saying. Maybe not other people in the stock selling industry, but look at the historical data yourself. See what you think. But one, it warns some people who are at least trying to be responsible, trying to do the right thing. Two, if we do suffer a crash, we're all going to have to pull together and we're going to have to pull ourselves out of this. And having the materials available at the website, I think, is a plus in that regard. Rather than waiting until after the crash to start digging our way out, I like to think that if we suffer that crash, we're going to have a opening the internet to honest posting on safe withdrawal rates and all other investing questions. And, you know, this communications technology may be one of the things that helps us save ourselves because people will have this information available and there will be, you know, 200 podcasts and 100 articles and 6 calculators and all this sort of thing. Let's hope. So I don't want to leave it on a totally dark note. But the bright note is one that we can turn this into something good. And the other bright note is I do think our understanding of the model is getting better. That it, you know, as I say in the title of the podcast, I was wrong. It's not strictly emotional reasons why we may go into a second crash. There's an economic reason why we are likely to experience another stock crash. Good luck with your investing strategies. Take care.